ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Don't have enough time to stay across all the latest news? ABC News Top Stories podcast explains the biggest breaking news stories and why they matter in less than 2 minutes. So you can hit play and get updated while brushing your teeth or making your lunch. It's always up to date, ready whenever you're ready to get across the day's news. Just search ABC News Top Stories podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts and hit follow or favourite to add us to your playlist.
The Prime Minister has confirmed Australia will deploy a military surveillance plane and missiles to the Middle East after a request from the UAE. Anthony Albanese has reiterated that Australia's involvement is purely defensive, noting his first priority is to keep Australians safe as they remain stranded in the region. At the same time, the Home Affairs Minister, Tony Burke, has confirmed 5 Iranian women's football players will remain in Australia after seeking asylum, extending the same offer to their teammates. It comes after the Prime Minister fielded an early phone call from US President Donald Trump over the fate of these women, with the US President then declaring on social media that Anthony Albanese was on it. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Karvelas.
And I'm a very caffeinated Tom Crowley. There seems to be going on in this building today, PK.
A very caffeinated version of the show is exactly as it should be, especially today. So it was an enormous morning of news. We're going to come to the members of the Iranian women's soccer team granted asylum in a moment, which is, can I say, elating for those of us who know what would happen to women going back when they have made it so clear that they are no fans of the regime and have, as I've been told, a variety of reasons for seeking asylum in terms of their safety in that country. So that is huge. But the first thing that the Prime Minister told us, flanked by the Deputy Prime Minister and the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, and the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, and the Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, like it was seriously full court, was what is a very significant announcement, huge, major announcement that Australia would be offering defensive assistance to the Gulf countries. Let's just take this for what it is. We are now deploying the ADF in the Middle East. This is no small thing. It is huge. The government tells us it's defensive, not offensive, i.e. we are not participating, the Prime Minister tells us, in offensive actions against Iran, as the US and Israel are doing. His reasons are very, very, very narrow around the safety of Australians, the defence of the Gulf states that are clearly being hit by Iran as a retaliatory action and an escalation of the war. But it still embroils us in a conflict very far away. And we do still have the legacy of Afghanistan and Iraq in our country where we participated, perhaps in a different way, but still participated. Just to be specific, we're providing sophisticated surveillance plane, a wedge tail as they're known, 85 ADF personnel as well. That's 85 Australians that are now going to be in the Middle East in harm's way, there is no doubt about it. The aircraft is set to help protect and secure the airspace above the Gulf. So this is huge. Tom, I'm throwing it back to you. Why now? Why this move? And talk to me about the government's rationale, the way that they have politically confined this deployment.
Well, the government emphasising two things. You mentioned one of them there, the fact that there are so many Australians in this part of the world. And the other one being that this particular aircraft is something that Richard Marles has certainly been saying this morning, that we're among the world leading users of it. We've got it. It's a very useful thing that we can do, pointing out that the UAE is shooting down already 1,500 Iranian missiles it's had to shoot down since this war began. And so that just gives you some sense of the volume and maybe a view there that Australia, you know, might have been, well, was asked to help and saw a case to help. Obviously, we're relying a lot on the government of the UAE here to kind of help to get Australians moving out, you know, both those who are transiting and those who are trying to come home who are based there. So those are the reasons. I mean, yeah, participant is that right word that just sits in the grey here. You know, it's sort of, I suppose, a slightly different word to belligerent. This is, I think it's probably fair to say a Ukraine level of involvement, and we wouldn't necessarily have thought of ourselves as joining the Ukraine war so much as sitting just on the cusp of it. And there's an element of that here. It's the same aircraft.
I think it goes a bit further, doesn't it?
Maybe, but just in terms of the specifics. I mean, I'll come to like the same aircraft, right? We're giving them what have been described as defensive missiles. We gave Ukraine, you know, tanks and various other things. To me, the key difference is in harm's way, those words that you said earlier, right? It's that in Ukraine, when we were helping NATO, we understand sort of patrolling based in Poland and patrolling airspace just outside of Ukraine as part of the NATO kind of patrol there. Maybe there was an element of remove with Russia not firing certainly as frequently on that kind of territory as we're seeing Iran fire on these Gulf states. And so it raises the risk of Australian defence personnel being, you know, being killed or injured or involved in this in a way that becomes a whole lot more serious. So it does. It sits in that kind of grey area. There's a different – that collective self-defense gives us a totally different international law type justification for our involvement than, you know, we don't necessarily have to sign up to the American and Israeli one to be a part of this, but it just builds to this sort of, ambiguous stance, you can call it that Australia has towards – the origins of this war.
Yeah, ambiguous stance is a good way to frame it. But also, let's look at the broader optics here. Donald Trump calls Anthony Albanese. Anthony Albanese has been incredibly careful and he thinks strategic in trying to maintain a very positive relationship with Donald Trump. I think he has been successful at achieving that. Donald Trump calls and is interested in the Iranian women's team. There's reasons for that. I think it's become a bit of a rallying call from the sort of right, even the sort of MAGA base, even in Australia, the right, you know, have been rallying behind these women.
Well, not One Nation though, PK, right? Like this is I think an interesting element of this is that Pauline Hanson and Barnaby Joyce together on the Carl Stefanovic podcast this week sounding pretty lukewarm about it, and James Ashby sounding even stronger in his public comments. Whereas Matt Canavan on the right flank of the Nationals said that this was just open and shut. There was no need to even talk about it. Of course, it's the right thing to do. So an interesting rupture on the right. But yes, I mean, by and large, tremendous support for this to happen. And certainly from the coalition, for the most part, supportive as well.
We'll give it context in a moment. I want to talk about whether Trump talked at all or what we know on the record still, just to finish off with our actual deployment to the Middle East. You know, that small thing, Tom, that small thing where we're actually sending our uniformed officers to the Middle East, not a small thing. Whether Trump raised that, we're defensive, not offensive, there are questions about whether this is also a nod to the US, right?
Totally.
And do we know? Do we have any clarity on that? I don't think we do.
I don't think we do. The Prime Minister didn't want to go into the details at all on what was discussed in what he did describe as a lengthy conversation with President Trump. He did mention that there was, as you would expect, some conversation broadly about the war. We understand that Trump called him, not the other way around. We sort of night owls might have in Australia perceived this sort of shift as Trump started to get quite worked up on Truth Social about this idea, and then within a couple of hours seemed to have spoken to the Prime Minister, seemed to have, I guess, maybe understood the sensitivities of this that the government had been dealing with all the way along, and he was using those words delicate situation that have been in the Labor talking points, and that one can only imagine that the Prime Minister emphasised to him, which we understand totally, right? Like the sensitivities for the government in not wanting to telegraph their plans with this group, given the prospect that could put them or their family members in danger. But what exactly they spoke about in the war, whether this is something that America new greenlit, what kind of request was made? No, we don't know. The Prime Minister saying that part of his ability to maintain good relationships with other leaders is that he doesn't blurt out these sorts of things. Of course, Donald Trump though went straight to Truth Social and gave his readout of the meeting of the meeting. So there's a bit of an imbalance there. But no, we don't know what they said about the war, and it's the first time we haven't really heard of any high official level contact between Australia and the Americans. Remember, Penny Wong kept sort of saying you wouldn't expect Marco Rubio to have picked up the phone to me because we're not the main characters here. Well, now the two leaders have spoken.
Yeah, they have, and it beggars belief that they wouldn't really have talked about this. And sure, Australia's framing is around safety of Australians. There's obviously a very big economic question about making sure that the air is safe and that they're the routes are sort of, you know, you're trying to maintain as much normality for the world economy. So that helps us in terms of our national interest, our sovereign interest. But I will tell you that I think we are kidding ourselves if we think this has nothing to do with the US-Australia alliance and that this isn't looked at positively, even if it's framed around support for the UAE and the defensive actions. It assists the US's ongoing operation. Do not be confused about that, right? Tom, we are enabling this potentially to continue. What I'm saying is controversial but true.
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit of a muddled position that the government has taken, right? I mean, it has contradictions in it, and it has from the beginning. And I think that this, you know, it's starting to become, into sharper relief as we go further and further on. From the get-go, the government's been saying, well, we support removing Iran's capacity to acquire nuclear weapons. We support stopping them from committing terrorism around the world. They've sounded very, very reluctant, though, on the regime change dimension. I think increasingly as time's gone on, the government's been really quite openly sceptical about the idea that that could be achieved from the air. And they're also reluctant to go anywhere near the international law dimension of this and offer a comment on whether the initial action was justifiable under international law, threading a bit of a tricky path because they want to be able to recognise that, well, international law hasn't really done a very good job of stopping the Iranian regime from doing all the things that it's been doing, and it's acted with impunity under the system of international law. So it has always been a little bit of a dog's breakfast of a position in one sense. But I think what the government would say is, well, how could it have been any other way? You look at what happened even to Keir Starmer, who really hasn't taken that different a position from us in the sense that he's participating in defensive actions but not going as far as Donald Trump would like. And Trump says, oh, this guy's no Winston Churchill, and went really hard after him. So I think when you're trying to thread a needle like that in government, it is going to look a little bit messy. And then when you try and draw distinctions between defensive and offensive actions, and when you start to become a participant, it gets even harder to sustain. But I don't think there was a really simple alternative that the government could have struck from the beginning here.
So let's look at the response. So Dan Tehan was on radio. He said he believed by taking this action, we were now active participants. I can see the logic in the argument he's making. It has merit. The Greens have been very strong in, scathing in the decision to deploy troops, right? So that's very interesting. They're not buying the confined nature of this. David Shoebridge saying this is Australia now actively involved in Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu's legal war. Now, Australia would not see it that way, but that's how they're framing it. Even Andrew Hastie, and this is so interesting, right? He's such an interesting player in all of this, mainly because he has the legitimacy as a former SAS soldier in Afghanistan. Like, you know, a lot of people can have opinions with their desky work. I put my hand up here too. His opinion matters to me, and his opinion matters because of that, those deployments particularly. He has warned about forever wars, and he's, you know, to give him credit, he has stayed consistent. He says, I am really worried about the long-term impact of this war on our region, particularly given we import so much of our fuel, right? So he puts it within his portfolio, the sort of, you know, fuel security, sovereignty is his thing, but it's also about us deploying troops. And I think that's really interesting, don't you?
Yeah, totally. And I think there's almost been a sense that the coalition, you know, is unshackled a little bit because they're in opposition and they're able to sort of speak about this. I mean, I guess when you don't have to take a position as a government, you are free to recognise, well, you're free to state the obvious in a way that the political leaders certainly feel that they are, that they have to sort of play these word games, and I'll take my language right up to here and you kind of understand what I mean by it, but I can't say what I mean by it. And all those word games that we've heard the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister playing, the coalition can just say, yeah, regime change doesn't normally work. Yeah, we'll see whether Trump's war aims are clear. Yeah, you know, the US are our allies and we really dislike Iran. Yeah, we support Australia being a participant, but not to the extent that it takes away our ability to defend ourselves. And James Patterson had sort of been you know, preparing for, well, if it's a frigate and if we're taking away from our naval capacity and we need that close to home, maybe we wouldn't support that. So they're able to flesh out that sort of position. The Greens are able to say that this is, you know, totally immoral from the get-go and that we should never have had anything to do with it in the first place. And yeah, I think it has made for a really interesting conversation, not least because there are quite a few veterans and former intelligence agencies as well on the crossbench in Andrew Wilkie. There's all sorts of people who bring their own personal experience to this, which has made for actually, I think, maybe an underratedly lively domestic political discussion about this war.
Mm. I want to pivot, if I can, just briefly to the sort of oil question, if I can call it that, because in an economic sense, Australia, of course, is in trouble in some ways because we rely a lot on, you know, foreign oil. So today, the Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, tried to downplay concerns around supply. He's insisting a shortage of supply was due to panic buying. He says, we have as much diesel in Australia today as we had before the crisis began. Okay, you're the one with the economics background. Is he right or is he tricking us?
It's a, can I cop out and say it's complicated and then give you a longer explanation? Is that
people hate journalists who say
that. I know, but this one, yeah, there are a lot of elements to this. So firstly, we are 90% of our fuel we import. So there is that reliance on overseas. We get most of it really from Singapore and Southeast Asia. That's where it gets refined, but the crude oil, you know, I think 1/5 of the world's crude oil comes through the Strait of Hormuz. So that gives you a sense of what a key artery this is in the global supply chain for crude oil to then come and get refined. Two refineries in Australia left that can do it, mm-hmm. but mostly it's Singapore. That's the question of the oil making its way here. And for now, though clearly there has been a big price shock and a lot of jitters globally, we're still getting some oil in for now. So when we talk about the stockpile and how much we've got waiting, Chris Bowen says 36 days of petrol, 32 days of diesel and 29 days of jet fuel. That's not a countdown as such where that's how many days we have left until we run out in this current scenario. That's saying if we get completely cut off, that's how much padding that we've got. And that is, the government has been saying, a number that is the highest it's been in 15 years, which seems to be true, but it's also a number that is quite a bit lower than what the International Energy Agency asks mostly advanced countries mm-hmm, mm-hmm. to keep aside for a whole global stockpile, and that's 90 days worth. We're, I think, the only country that is signed up to that IEA arrangement that doesn't have anywhere near the 90 for whatever reasons. But we still do have that 30-something. The minister does have some powers, should we drop down into the 20s, to make some sort of tougher requirements on petrol companies to keep a stockpile. So that's the policy landscape. But then there is this kind of chaos and confusion, not with the supply, but the supply chain, and that it, particularly how the oil, once in Australia, flows out all through the country and to regional areas in particular, because always when we talk about petrol, we know that it's harder for regional areas. A, you've got people who need a lot more of it to drive around longer distances on farms and all that sort of thing. They're often paying more because there's less competition wherever they are. And so they have it tough to begin with. But what we're also seeing here is that often regional areas are serviced by small wholesalers, and the wholesalers buy from the so-called big four oil companies. And they might, some of them might have ongoing contracts, but a lot of them are just seem to be buying on a bit of a needs basis on what's called the spot market. And so David Littleproud from the Nationals is saying, well, firstly, that's leaving them pretty squeezed, because the spot market, you get the volatility of all this global chaos in the oil price. So they're already having to wear a little bit of the risk of the war going on for longer. But secondly, suggestion that some of the big four are saying we're not going to sell on the spot market at the moment while we just wait and see what's going on. And Chris Bowen is saying that all existing contracts are being honoured, but there's a little bit of confusion still about essentially some of these small regional buyers of petrol and whether they are currently able to buy. And clearly, all the way out on the end of the farmers and some of these small retailers, they're saying, no, we can't, and we're worried. And so there's a lot of confusion that's going to need to be cleared up in some way or another. Chris Bowen understandably sending the message of, overall, don't panic. We have enough fuel. We will work through these supply chain issues. But clearly there's a lot of consternation.
There's so much consternation about that. Well explained. I want to pivot to somewhere we've already been, which is this just after 2 a.m. This morning phone call with Donald Trump, where he raised the question of these Iranian women soccer players. Like, the backstory here is, of course, after they didn't sing the Iranian national anthem and then there were threats against them on Iranian state television, there became a bit of a movement, particularly online, even, you know, sort of forceful right-wingers saying the Australian government should give them asylum. Even late last week, I was making calls to key people in the government saying, are we going to offer them asylum? It was clear to me something was happening, but they were very careful about the cohort, how they did it. There was, now we can reveal, and I think they've made it quite clear, a lot of urging us to be very careful in our reporting, which is always a bit vexed for journalists, you know, because we just like, when we have yarns, we like to share yarns. But equally, I think threatening the lives of women is something very serious, and I think we all took it pretty seriously. Then, in the middle of the night, you know, like there was a sort of dashed flight, and the Minister for Home Affairs was offering asylum to five Iranian football players who clearly had made it very clear that they would like to not go back. And that was quite an elaborate process, right? We're talking ASIO, the federal police. There needs to be vetting to ensure. Think about all of the ISIS brides controversies we've had. You know, the government had to be, let me tell you the backstory. They were not wanting to walk into something that would put them at risk, where someone then starts writing that one of them is a radical and they've made this wrong call. So they're being very careful. The current position they have is that any of the other women can also claim asylum and that they will facilitate that. So far as we record on a Tuesday morning, they haven't yet. However, I can also add that there is now, the Iranians are trying to get the women, the remaining women, out quickly before any others defect. So that's happening. So the Australian government gets now lauded by Donald Trump for doing this. To be fair to our Australian government, they were always trying to do this. They were always aware that these women deserved protection. Where are we at, Tom?
Yeah, and I think that there's a rightful wariness of any journalist when the government says, you know, be careful about saying X, Y, Z. But in this instance, I think the reason for it was clear. So, and the timeline is important as well. So Tony Burke said this morning that it was a day previous that it became clear that the government had been wanting to give all of the women as many opportunities as possible to signal if they wanted help, and that for a while they weren't sure whether they did. But that these five, it became clear a day ago, and that he had spent two nights in Brisbane trying to make this work, and then ultimately was in a position to publish these, you know, really quite touching photos. The Home Affairs portfolio isn't always necessarily one for touching images, and Tony Burke maybe doesn't necessarily isn't someone we see smiling a lot. But in this instance, there was him pictured in a hotel room with the five women around him, clearly very excited to be Australians.
I can tell you that it was, as he sees it, like one of the best moments of his working life. Like, think about that. Just the enormity of that, right? Think about why you want to win government, right? If you're a decent person, that is, you want to do it for the power to intervene, to help people, right? If you get to do that when you know these people will be harmed, and then you get to do that, Tom, could there be anything better? I cannot imagine any better feeling, honestly. Like, what a dopamine hit, being able to go cause and effect. I did this thing and these women will now be able to live free lives here.
Yeah, and I think that the publicity of it, the fact that they were here for a global tournament that the Matildas were playing in, and that just the significance of the public's attention on that, I think made it a story that was kind of irresistible. So layered and complicated, of course, because, you know, we do always worry about what a difficult decision it is for them to make, given what could happen to their family members back in Iran. And for the other women in the team, you know, no doubt. And Burke was keen to say this as well this morning, that it was totally understandable why the women would potentially make either decision, and that it wasn't necessarily going to be a clear-cut thing.
No, because it's
them.
A lose-lose decision for these women. I want to be clear about that. It's like, it's not, I made it out like it's sort of fairy tale and it just, oh, they're living happy and they're kicking a football here and doing whatever they like, you know?
It's an awful, awful situation.
The whole thing is quite enormous, but yeah, there are consequences for your family back home.
Totally. And countless, of course, you know, other women back in Iran who we know, you know, continue to be at risk in their, you know, in their own lives as well. It's such a deeper story. I thought it was interesting that Tony Burke made a point of saying that he had spoken to Mike Burgess, the ASIO Director General, to clear off this group in a security perspective. That's obviously an assessment that's been made reasonably quickly, but he was eager to say that it had been done. Tim Wilson, the Shadow Treasurer, slightly different talking points actually this morning than what some of the others seem to say, because as you said, Julian Lisa has been really taking the lead. His electorate has a very large Iranian-Australian, Persian-Australian community, and he's been advocating for this group most vocally. But Tim Wilson was pointing out the previous criticisms that the coalition's had about rushing, you know, perception of rushing a security process for people coming from Gaza and all that sort of thing, and saying normal process should be followed. And there were these criticisms from some in One Nation, you know, now who are a prominent voice on these issues as well, expressing more reservations about this. So there are some different views sitting out there. It'll be interesting to see how that one unfolds. I think ultimately the sentiment of the public will probably, you know, be on the side of these women, and it will read as a good news story. And as you say, there are a lot of voices on the political right who were calling for this. So it's a complicated one.
Well, it is more neutralised by the fact that it's the right, including Donald Trump, sort of the president of the sort of populist right in the world, carries a lot of weight, even in Australia, right? Even among right-wing voters in Australia. So I think the Trump intervention is key. Oh, biggest Tuesday ever, can I say. We have deployed troops to the Middle East, given asylum to Iranian women's soccer players. My favourite genre of human, by the way, are female soccer players. So it's a happy day for me and my household too.
And we're going to pass super tax changes, and I didn't even get to talk about it. That's how many other things are going on today. PM just dropped a little line at the end saying, hey, this little tax reform we've been dangling around for 3 years is going to pass. Just a sign of how much is happening today.
Oh, just that tiny thing, the sort of super tax that's been completely held up and is in no man's land has all of a sudden found some land. What a time to be Australian. That's it for the podcast for today. Tomorrow, Claire Armstrong will join me for Politics Now, and we'll bring you all the latest. Of course, Thursday, we've got the Party Room. We're also doing a special bonus episode of the Party Room Question Time. Send your questions to the Party Room at abc.net.au. See you, Tom.
See ya.